Okay. Well, unlike Mason, I don't have the ability to talk for 45 minutes straight. That was a cheap one, but he's not even out here. I was really looking forward to saying that, but he's not out here. So we'll see how long this goes. It won't be long by any means. If in the case I do get done in 20 minutes or something, Jonah's agreed to lead us in more songs, so we're covered on that end.
I can't sing for 45 minutes.
Well, you know, make up the difference. So I did draw this diagram on the board. Teaching this year, I room hop, so I've not had time to set up, you know, PowerPoints and things in my classroom, so I've reverted back to the old ways of the Stone Age, writing on a whiteboard, and so I didn't want to bother with that tonight, and so here we are. I just put that back up there. That is more to keep me organized as I go, because I am going to be hopping around a little bit, so hopefully that benefits you, and I will refer to that often. For those, I guess we are missing a lot of our number, but for those who regularly attend here, Mason's approach over the past, as long as I can remember him being here, he likes to push his themes, and the biggest one I can remember is the idea of king and kingdom, and it's been the driving force of most of his topical discussions, I think, and funnily enough, this was probably most clear to me when we did the Big Beautiful Story during COVID. If you don't know what I'm talking about, during COVID, when we were doing some things on Zoom, it was the Big Beautiful Story, and it was kind of to appeal to the younger kids and things like that, and it was broken down into the big stories of the Bible, and Mason did a great job of always bringing it around to the idea of king and kingdom, and I'm very grateful that our younger generation here gets to look at many of their studies through that lens. It's very focused, and I applaud the efforts that Mason and our elders have made to put that structure in place, and they did not come up with that structure, I get it, but they've provided us the framework to see things through that bigger, to that bigger picture. And also the summer series, I feel, has done a great job of giving us that broader scope in our studies as well, and I heard a ton of great things this past summer. I don't know if I was paying more attention than I normally do, but things were just jumping out at me left and right, and it was the life of David, and as always, I feel like I need to make this disclaimer. I know a lot of my thoughts may not be original to all of you, but some of them are to me, so I'm not naive enough to think I'm coming up with something great and grand here, but my enthusiasm sort of began with this topic in the summer series, and through some of the realizations I made in those studies, and hopefully through me laying out my line of thinking, and just the study I put into this is going to maybe shed some light on some questions you've been having or things you're studying currently, and as always, discussion is welcome on any of my thoughts. So the typology that is prevalent through the life of David, that idea has been taught about many times, and I remember kind of realizing that at a younger age, and it was the focus of a lot of studies. And to me, it's another affirmation of the beautiful design that God has in place with some of those with those teachings and those scriptures. This summer series, though, again, it was just like, oh my goodness, I didn't even realize some of these things and these connections. And Dominic's lesson, which was, I think he was third to last, Dominic Venuso, if I remember right. His lesson was kind of the final story we read about of David. He talked about the census and what all went into that. And then as he was wrapping up, the things I started reading, because I got excited and I started reading ahead, and there were things I had never realized that went into that story, especially the fact that David purchased the threshing floor. I don't even remember who he bought it from. What's his name? I don't know. Anyways, that threshing floor that he purchased was where the temple would be built. And I probably heard that tons of times, again, but never really paid attention enough to make that connection for myself. And the way Dominic put that together with David's shortcomings in the story of the census really got my wheels turning, and I started to realize a pattern that I'd sort of been missing all along. So what I want to talk about tonight is this idea of a temple progression that we see throughout the Bible. And the idea of temple progression isn't the new idea that occurred to me, and it's something we've studied before, but and temple being the idea of God dwelling with his people. If you look at the diagram I drew, this is sort of the different temples I want to focus on tonight. And I realize that these aren't going to be every temple that's ever discussed in Scripture. I think these are sort of the most monumental, if that's the right word to use, sort of benchmarks throughout the story of the Bible. And again, the idea of going from one temple to the next was not really a new idea to me, but the way I began looking at how the temple progression occurred was what got my attention. So the questions I started asking were, what specific events and people were involved when that new version of the temple sort of sprang into existence? And what was done with those people to make sure that that temple came about, that new version of the temple came about? So I realize this is going to be out of order. That's why I put that diagram up there. But to kind of show you what I'm talking about, I want to skip to what Dominic was talking about and go to that temple. And again, what Dominic did was break down sort of the thoughts and emotions that were going into David's decisions about his census. If just a brief recap, he did the census, and for whatever reason, it didn't go well for him, and disaster ended up striking Israel. And Dominic did a great job of sort of showing or highlighting some of David's characteristics that we'd seen in the past, and his decisions negatively affected those around him ultimately. And then he connected that story to the final story we read about David purchasing the threshing floor. And so to me, that's the significant part, is when David, being the one who purchases the threshing floor, that's what I believe to be sort of when the new temple version comes into play. Hopefully you understand what I'm talking about here in a minute. If we look back at when David first desired to build a temple and God denied him, let's read that really quick. 1 Chronicles chapter 22. First Chronicles 22, verses 6 through 10. Then he, David, called for Solomon, his son, and charged him to build a house for the Lord, the God of Israel. David said to Solomon, "My son, I had it in my heart to build a house to the name of the Lord my God, but the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'You have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name, because you have shed so much blood before me on the earth. Behold, a son shall be born to you, who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his surrounding enemies, for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name. He shall be my son, and I will be his father. And I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever.'" So there's obviously a lot that can go into that scripture that isn't really what I'm going to be focusing on tonight. But what Dominic did was connected the idea of David and the temple to David's life. And for the sake of time, I won't go into all the details of Dominic's lesson. But if you remember what David said at the end of chapter 21 of 1 Chronicles, he insisted heavily on paying for the threshing floor. And it was kind of an odd thing to come about, because he could have taken it for free. And so Dominic highlighted the significance of that attitude of David wanting and insisting to pay for that threshing floor coming after this disastrous census that occurred. David's attitude towards the census was more to his own fame and his own glory than it was for the glory of God. And so David then came to the conclusion for a sacrifice to be worthy on that threshing floor, because he was going to build an altar there, it had to cost him something. So that's why he insisted on paying for that threshing floor. That's the whole idea of the sacrifice. For David to be a worthy sacrifice or a blessing, it must cost him something. And this is where my wheels sort of got turning. I wrote down the phrase in my notes, sacrificial blessing, to illustrate this. And so if we look at the moment that David purchased that threshing floor to build the altar as a moment of temple progression, then we see what was necessary to achieve that moment in time to progress to that temple. Someone had to step up and be a sacrificial blessing. So hopefully that sort of illustrates what I'm going for here. So with the rest of our time, I'd like to try and highlight the important people that were a part of this temple progression and working in conjunction with God's power and grace, obviously. And I think it's very beneficial to see that pattern as people being a sacrificial blessing that helped achieve that. So I'm hoping, again, because I'm sort of skipping. You can kind of tell there's another temple in between the one I have there, which I realize is now off-center with the courtyard. It's really bothering me. Yeah, I don't know why I did that. There's another one there, and you could make arguments for other versions. So I realize I'm skipping around, and I'm hoping that tonight we kind of make that pattern more easy. So in order of my diagram, however, I have the garden listed first. And ultimately, this was kind of the first and most pure version of a temple that God had with his people. And there really wasn't an individual or a group of people that brought this or achieved this version of temple. But I really think that the undoing of this temple kind of illustrates my point as well. So everything fell apart with the garden when Adam and Eve ultimately could no longer be sacrificial, and that's when sin entered the world. So it may not seem it, but abstaining from the tree that God commanded was a form of sacrifice. It doesn't seem like it, but I think that kind of follows that pattern. And so when that sacrifice was no longer being honored, when Eve ate from that tree and Adam also, disaster struck. So again, I'm skipping around. We're going to come back and talk about the garden, because it comes into play a lot more here towards the end. But hopefully you see how the undoing of that temple also demonstrates the need for people to be sacrificial blessings. So next then was the tabernacle. It's the next sort of formal temple that God has with his people. And obviously, keeping in mind, just because there's no formal structure in place does not, just because there isn't a physical tent or a building, doesn't mean that God is not dwelling with his people. But I think temples were the physical illustration of that idea, and we see that each one gets better as we progress, and that's a common theme throughout Hebrews, throughout the Bible, really. So if we think of one person associated with that tabernacle, with the old law, I think it's pretty easy for us to all agree with Moses on that. And there may be differing opinions on kind of the timeline I constructed about that progression to the tabernacle. But there's one specific instance with Moses that I'd really like to point out. So something that always stood out to me as a kid, probably just because it was so visual, was the idea of the pillar of cloud or fire settling on the tabernacle, or it would fill the tabernacle with God's presence. And so just to bring that up, let's read the last five verses of Exodus chapter 40, so the very end of Exodus. Exodus chapter 40. Read verse 34 through the end there. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of God filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So if I'm an Israelite, to me, that's probably one of the most striking things that would stick out in my mind, is seeing that pillar of cloud, that pillar of fire, because to them it was that physical presence of God that oftentimes they were seeking. It was a constant reminder to the Israelites that he was with them. So imagine if they woke up one day and that was gone. The pillar of cloud was gone, the pillar of fire was gone. You can almost hear their voices in your head, when they were freaking out because they didn't have food to eat. That kind of scenario. Where did he go? We've been forsaken. Take us back to Egypt. God is no longer with us. So to them, that pillar of cloud and fire was their security. And the tabernacle probably wouldn't mean much to them if they did not have that association with the presence of God being with that tabernacle. So I bring that up to get us back to this point of the main point. So when the first time, what was the first time the Israelites saw that pillar of cloud? So right at the beginning of their journey out of Egypt, it was actually their leader through the wilderness. It talks about, let's read Exodus 13. This is going to be a bit of a lengthier read. Exodus chapter 13, starting in verse 17, and we'll go through chapter 14, verse 20. Just kind of set the scene here. Focusing on the idea of God's presence in the form of that pillar of cloud, pillar of fire. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, "Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here." And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, "What is this that we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel, while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you only have to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. So I really love the imagery that that story gives us. And again, this being the first time that the Israelites probably saw that pillar of cloud, it's a very strong relationship they were already feeling with that presence of God. So back to the main question then, how did Moses play a significant role in this temple progression that we see to the tabernacle? Because the tabernacle isn't anywhere near being mentioned at this point. And really, I'm hoping you see the connection between the pillar of cloud and the tabernacle that the Israelites would have had together. That strong association. So prior to this, Moses had obviously been in the forefront of the battle against Pharaoh to release Israel. However, if you recall the sort of reluctance and hesitance that he showed before that time and throughout that time, to me, the story that we just read, we see sort of a different version of Moses here. He's physically leading out the Israelites into the wilderness. He stepped up in a way that maybe he hadn't committed to before. He took on the role of Israel's leader, and they saw him as that without a doubt. They turned to Moses in that time of panic, that time of terror, and they knew that he was their leader as well as the Lord. Right in that moment, I believe he became that sacrificial blessing by stepping up that Israel needed to get to that next temple progression. It led to that tabernacle. So hopefully the way I laid that out made sense, but I really, in a nutshell, Moses became that sacrificial blessing. He decided to be a blessing to the Israelites as their leader. And in that moment, the Israelites saw that physical dwelling of God with them begin when that pillar of cloud was leading them and also protecting them from the Egyptians. So next in our temple progression, then, we started with the garden. We went to Moses and the tabernacle. And I already talked about this one, but David and the temple, which again is interesting because David was not the one that built the temple. But if you remember what I said, this is where I started us with a callback to Dominic's lesson, his thoughts. David was that sacrificial blessing in that sense when he bought the threshing floor for an arguably obscene price from that man, and he wanted to build that altar, and that ultimately, I believe, led to the temple that everyone thinks about, you know, the temple, the one you see in your Bible pictures. So that's where I got that one from, actually. Google. It didn't do me justice, I don't think. So I could talk about that one for hours, because that was really when I got my wheels turning, and looking back at my notes I had written in my phone as I typed furiously through Dominic's lesson, kind of looks like the ramblings of a madman now. So I thought about that movie scene where you walk into some psychopath's bedroom and he's got pictures all over the wall, tacked to the wall, and strings thrown everywhere connecting the dots. And so I won't do that to you guys. I already did that with Maddie. It didn't go very well. She kind of just stared at me like I was insane, but I did read her the final product. She said it made sense now, so I'm taking her word for it. So I'll go ahead and get to that next version of the temple that really is extremely important to us, and we all know that. So what we have now, and really we're almost done here, is I don't really feel the need to sort of lay out why Jesus was the sacrificial blessing that led us to that temple progression in that sense. Plain and simple, the story of the crucifixion and when the temple veil is torn in two. To me, that illustrates so much that temple veil. That's a temple veil, if you couldn't tell. I tried to put the curtain on. I don't know. Who knows what it looked like? I've watched too many Bible Project videos, if you can't tell, and watched Elizabeth teach class too many times. So that illustrates to me why it's so important to know the story of the Old Testament and the illustrations that it gives us to understand why that's so significant. So imagine reading Matthew 27 and verse 51 without that understanding of the temple veil. So if you read this, "And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split." So the temple is referenced in the New Testament several times, a lot of times. And but without understanding the role that that temple veil played, by reading the Old Testament and understanding that it separated us from the most holy place and you couldn't enter there, that phrase really doesn't hold much weight. The temple veil was torn in two. If you did not know that, it does not hold much weight, I don't think. So at that moment, we progress to such a powerful role in that temple progression. And for all of us, it's the new way that God would dwell with his people. And so, again, this bears even more weight now as we consider where we go from here. So if you're sitting closer, you can probably tell this, but I have the arrows drawn in somewhat of a circle. And this is not to imply that this is a cycle in the sense that we can go around and around and around again, but rather all things lead back to that first version of temple. The first version of God dwelling with his people and the pure, unadulterated reliance in dwelling with God. I believe that's really what heaven is, and that's what we're striving for. So that's what the point of this lesson is to illustrate that temple progression all the way back to the beginning where we have that pure, unadulterated dwelling with God. And that's why the version of the temple we're in now means so much to us. Because we now must become that sacrificial blessing to achieve that ultimate and final version of the temple, but not only for ourselves, but for others as well. So think about what we're instructed to do. We're instructed to teach, evangelize. When we share the good news with others, it's a sacrifice. It's hard. But ultimately, that is what makes us a blessing to those around us. You can be as generous as you want, but if it's not through the scope of trying to bring others to that final temple, it's for nothing. I truly think that the times we see the disarray that the people of Israel are in is undone when someone steps up to be that sacrificial blessing. I acknowledge again that the four sort of temples I have listed here are not the only time this occurs. You think of Abraham, you think of Joseph, Zerubbabel, so many other stories where you see people stepping up. And I think the argument can be made that we progress to another version of God dwelling with his people in that sense. And when everything seems to stall out in the time of the kings, we just cycle through bad king, bad, bad, bad. It sort of just fluctuates until we get to Jesus becoming that ultimate sacrifice that gets us out of that rut. And so now it's our turn. And with many of these other people, they probably didn't know when that time was going to take place for them. Moses had a general idea of what was going to happen because God was talking to him, but he wasn't really sure when he was going to have to step up and be that physical leader that Israel needed. Same thing with all the other examples you can think of. We don't know when it's going to happen to us. But it's happening now in a sense. But that trumpet call for the resurrection, it's going to be the final call when we progress to that final temple version. And the best temple that is dwelling with God. So Hebrews really does a much better job saying everything I've said tonight. And in the context of the whole book being about something better, I pulled out one of the verses of Hebrews chapter 10 verse 14. Says, "For by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified." So this is what the sacrifice of Jesus means to us, and that temple progression, what it does for us. We now have the opportunity to become those living sacrifices that Paul talks about in Romans. That's how we get to that final temple. See if you recognize this, these lines from a song. There behold his agony, suffered on the bitter tree. See his anguish, see his faith, love triumphant still in death. Then to life I turn again, learning all the worth of pain, learning all the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice. So that's from the song, When My Love to Christ Grows Weak. And we sang that about a month ago, and it just struck me, that final stanza, sort of because I'd been studying this. And it's a beautiful song with that beautiful imagery again, and I think it highlights what I'm trying to say so well. So I hope we can all come to realize the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice, like that song says. And just know right now that the world needs it. It needs people to step up in a time where people are afraid to step up. And so my encouragement to you tonight is to progress to that next temple together and bring everyone with us that we can. Let's be sacrificial blessings to those around us. And I think we're doing a great job of it here. And my encouragement to you now is to go out into the world and do that as well. Thank you.